Professor Richard Somerville is my guest, and if you just joined us and you're wondering about his credentials, he is a distinguished professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, University of California, San Diego, received a PhD in meteorology from New York University in 1966. He is interested in, studies all aspects of climate science and climate policy. He comments frequently on climate and environmental issues for the media. Also testified before the U.S. Congress, briefed United Nations climate change negotiators, advised government agencies. The professor is also coordinating lead author for the 2000 assessment report on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And here's the kind of thing you get. We'll let the professor respond to this after the break. Ron in New York, New York writes, "Art, if your guest is indeed an expert, it's as a bully and propagandist. Anybody who starts a discussion by claiming settled science and scientific consensus is there to lecture and browbeat." His response in a moment. Professor Ron in New York, New York, you heard it. Browbeat, bully and browbeat, lecture and browbeat. Settled science. He's complaining about that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Ron, that you feel that way. I would say to inform, not to lecture or browbeat. You know, science isn't democratic, and we all know Einstein famously said that if he were wrong, it would only take one person with proof to show that he was wrong. The fact that the great majority of people knowledgeable about this subject take the position that I've been expressing doesn't mean that it's perfect. It just means that at this stage, the research frontier has moved on, and there's some things that we don't have to re-examine. There are many open questions, and I've discussed many of them on this show already. But the basics, the idea of what the greenhouse effect is, how it works, and whether or not we're adding to it, that's been well understood since the 19th century. Laboratory experiments were done long, long ago in which people took gases like carbon dioxide, put them in the lab, and showed how they trapped heat. This is not mysterious any longer. It was settled science quite some time ago. And as I said, the predictions are coming true. It's exactly again like medicine. The fact that medicine hasn't cured all diseases doesn't mean that you can ignore your doctor when you go for your physical and she says, look, you're heading for a heart attack. You know, you've got to shape up, exercise more, eat more sensibly. You don't say to your doctor, what day is the heart attack coming, and what will the surgical options be available on that day? Those are unreasonable questions. You accept that medical science has made a firm link between how you eat and whether you exercise and your chances of a heart attack. And climate science is very much the same way. We're planetary physicians, and we're simply saying that the science here is very well understood. The IPCC is the expression of mainstream science. And the fact that there are outliers, that there are dissenters, skeptics, or contrarians, shouldn't be taken out of proportion. There are contrarians in all fields of science. You know, there's a famous retrovirus expert at the University of California, Berkeley, who doesn't think that HIV causes AIDS. And his colleagues, as far as I can tell, think he can no longer be reasoned with on that subject. But you're not going to bet your health on that, and if you're infected, you're not going to refuse to seek treatment because of that one contrarian. And I think in many ways the climate science is in the same boat here. There's a shrill minority of people who dissent from the mainstream. They haven't made their case in a way that convinces their colleagues, and you don't want to bet the planet on them.
Bet the planet. Professor, how much do you think the oil and energy companies are contributing to this contrarian point of view with money and contrarian views made public?
That's changing very rapidly, Art. It's well known that some of the oil majors, ExxonMobil is a notable example, have contributed to what I and many of my colleagues regard as a disinformation campaign in much the same way that the tobacco industry, portions of it for a long time, mounted a major public campaign to essentially confuse people about the link between smoking and health. But that part of the industry is changing very rapidly. And many corporations, including ExxonMobil, have said that they're much more convinced now of the reality and seriousness of this problem. The degree to which that statement's followed up by action is something people can dispute. But I think it's quite clear that the oil majors in particular are interested in seeing a solution to this problem. They can foresee, for example, their regulation is coming down the pike, and they'd like to be part of planning it. You know, British Petroleum famously changed its name to Beyond Petroleum. And I think because there are going to be efforts to use alternative sources of energy to a greater extent than has been the case in the past, I think that's good. These are companies that have a big stake in it, that have great resources, great expertise, and they want to see progress made. They're subject to these regulations worldwide. You know, one of the Saudi oil ministers famously used to say that the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones, but it happened because we figured out better ways to do things. And I think that you can say the same thing if you're hopeful that the oil age will not end when we run out of oil. It will end as we discover better ways to make energy with fewer harmful side effects. So I applaud the efforts of the oil majors, just as I applaud the efforts of many corporations and politicians. You know, California has passed a very strong bill. The governor, Schwarzenegger, has signed it. The legislature passed it to drastically reduce California's emissions of carbon dioxide in coming decades. And in this area, as in many other areas, I think the size and economic clout of California is going to help propel that to a nationwide and, I hope, an international campaign. Other countries are taking similar steps. Many corporations and municipalities in this country are. And one can be hopeful that the federal government will also see the light.
Professor, I recently saw Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And frankly, some of the visual evidence that was in that movie, I thought was not only compelling, but scary as hell. Was it scientifically, in your view, accurate?
Well, you can dispute it. There are parts of that movie that I, if I'd been on Al Gore's advisory committee, would have said, let's not quite say it this way, you know. But on the other hand, in terms of the basics, you know, I think he's done a really good job. I can quibble. I'm an expert. I can say, gee, I didn't like this particular way of talking about the ice sheets in Greenland or talking about Katrina. But I think overall the explanation is good. It's heartfelt. You know, I think that it was clear the vice president is sincere about that. He has a longstanding interest in this subject. He was interested in climate change while he was still in Congress before he became vice president. And I think on the whole, he's done a good job. He's certainly helped to bring this to the consciousness of many, many people. Unfortunately, American politics being what it is, the vice president is a polarizing figure on this issue. And just as the Bush-Gore election was very close, I think you'll find people that don't want to listen to the message just because Al Gore is not the politician they'd prefer to hear it from.
That's right.
I'm sorry personally that this issue has become politically polarized in this country. It doesn't have to be that way. In many other countries, it's not a left-wing, right-wing, or liberal-conservative polarization. For example, the newly elected president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, who's a law-and-order guy, a tough conservative politician, in his acceptance speech mentioned the United States only to say, we hope the United States, who is our friend, will not disagree with us on climate policy, but will take helping to end the global warming crisis seriously because it's going to be a priority for France. And I think that's true all over the rest of the world. There are many centrist and center-right politicians who take this issue seriously. Unfortunately, in the U.S., it has become identified with a wing of the Democratic Party exemplified by Al Gore. So I think he's done a good job in terms of making a movie that's accessible to the wider public. Obviously, it's had a lot of audience success. They won an Oscar. But I wish it came from a less polarizing figure. I tell people who don't like the movie because they don't like Al Gore to pretend it's their favorite baseball player or somebody that they do like. Just change the messenger mentally.
All right, what about the other side? Michael Crichton's State of Fear. I read that also.
Yeah, Michael Crichton's a highly successful thriller writer, science fiction writer. I've debated him. He's clueless about climate science, and I think that book does a great disservice. It promotes as fact, the footnotes in the book whereas in fact they are full of inaccuracies, distortions, cherry-picked evidence, and claims that have long ago been disproved. So I'm very sad that somebody of Michael Crichton's stature and celebrity, who has a great following and is a huge commercially successful popular author, has chosen to go down that path.
I was very surprised by it. I was extremely surprised by it. I really like most of everything Michael Crichton has done, and that one kind of stopped me cold.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what got him off on this issue. He seems to. I mean, I'm sure he's sincere. I'm sure he has a closed mind. I don't understand why. You know, he's a fabulously successful author. I was looking at his website before I debated him, and it said at one time he had the number one movie and the number one bestseller. That must have been Jurassic Park or the Andromeda Strain or something like that, and the number one TV show. He's responsible for ER also. And a guy with that degree of success, enormous popular esteem, celebrity, he has a rock star, charismatic celebrity personality, why he's chosen to go down what, to my mind, is very clearly a wrong path mystifies me and saddens me very much, because we need people like that who have the ability to communicate well to the public, to get on board with the scientific message that needs to be conveyed.
Do you see it changing, Professor? You said it's polarizing. It is indeed polarizing, terribly polarizing,
yeah.
And it seems to still be. I mean, are you making progress?
Well, I think so. The polling numbers show that people are concerned. People are, in fact, out ahead of the federal government on this issue. I think the message that they don't want to leave a damaged planet to their children and grandchildren resonates with a lot of people. So I'm continually asked, what can I do, says Joe Sixpack, the man in the street. What can one person do? Does it help to recycle a can or bike to work or telecommute? And I think the answer to that is, sure, it does. It does help, and multiplied by 300 million people in this country, it helps a lot. But I think the other thing one can do is to tell the politician who's asking for your vote that this is an important issue to you, that everybody has it on their list of good things to happen, but it's not the number one issue. It's number 17 or something like that. And if you tell the politician it's important to you, then I think things will happen. And we're seeing politicians on both sides of the spectrum, several on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side. John McCain, for example, has been a co-sponsor of pioneering legislation. So I don't think this necessarily has to be restricted politically. And I sense a greater movement here. And I think also it's a false dichotomy to say that there are more important problems than this, so let's work on terrorism and better education and strengthening the economy. I think all of those things can certainly be done, as can this. As I said, in many cases, there are negative costs to doing this. There's money to be made. You know, Toyota is watching those hybrid Priuses fly off the lot.
Oh, yes.
And the people who are making gas-guzzling SUVs are having to give deep discounts to sell them. So I think things like that are an illustration of the fact that smart corporations are figuring out how to get on board here. And environmentalism can be profitable. It's not accurate to say we're choosing between economic prosperity and safeguarding the environment.
Okay, well, as you know, Kyoto here is dead as a doornail.
Yep.
I guess it's your view it wouldn't have helped that much?
It wouldn't have helped that much in the sense that if everybody had signed on to Kyoto, which was a treaty that essentially asked for a relatively small reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, a few percent, 5, 6, 7% below the 1990 level was the requirement. If everybody had signed on to that, nobody cheated, and everybody managed to meet their target, it would still be a very small reduction, because we're still emitting more and more greenhouse gases, and they pile up in the atmosphere. They last 100 years and more, some of them. But I think what diplomatic experience has shown is that for a lot of these agreements, it's important to get that first baby step taken, because you might say passing Kyoto at least gets you past the barricade of having Kyoto as an obstacle. And then you can go ahead and discuss more serious things. You know, Kyoto did come into force. It's a binding international treaty now. The U.S. and a couple of other countries haven't signed it, but enough countries with enough total emissions have signed it so that it's in force. And that means that we're affected by it. A U.S. Multinational company that's doing business in a country which has a Kyoto target has to restrict its emissions there. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Some people say they don't want to do these things because it costs money. Well, we're paying that money now. You know, if Katrina is an example of a natural disaster, that whether or not it's caused by global change is an illustration, because it shows how we're all paying for it. The cost of Katrina not being borne by the citizens of the region affected alone, they're being borne nationally. If you have agricultural problems due to droughts and so on, it affects everybody. If the Chinese are competing for oil on the open market, that raises your gasoline prices. Mm-hmm. And so it's, again, the medical metaphor is if you have the preventive surgery, it involves risk and expense. But if you postpone it till the heart attack comes, that's more risk and greater expense.
Sure. Is global warming in any way connected to the ozone hole? And I'd like to talk about the ozone hole a little bit. Well, let's start there. Is it connected to global warming?
There are connections. It's not entirely unrelated, but basically they are two separate issues. One of the connections is that the gases that are now being phased out by international agreement, because they cause the ozone hole, things like freons, the chlorofluorocarbons, turn out also to be greenhouse gases. So they have the dual disadvantage that they destroy ozone in the stratosphere, in the ozone layer, and they trap heat, add to the greenhouse effect. So that's one connection, and there are several others. But basically, it's two separate effects with two separate causes. It's illustrative, though, because the ozone hole issue is one that the scientific community would say has been successfully dealt with. The industry, the scientists, governments got on the same page, realized what the problem was, outlawed the offending gases. The chemical industry, DuPont, and other big companies developed ozone-safe substitutes for them. So if you buy a car today, it's air conditioned, it doesn't have ozone-depleting gases. And so that was an example of how international activity with corporations, scientists, governments all working together can solve problems. The greenhouse effect, the global warming problem, is much, much more difficult. But nonetheless, you have that.
Professor, I'm sorry. Have we actually made the holes smaller? I've heard conflicting reports on that.
We have not made it smaller. What we have done is taken the steps that we are confident will in future make it smaller, because those gases are still up there. What we have done is greatly reduced the rate at which they're being added to the atmosphere. And so it will take time. It might take 50 years to heal the ozone hole. But we're already seeing a reduction in some of the offending gases or the precursors, the chemical constituents that lead to those ozone-destroying reactions. We're seeing progress there. So we still have a very serious ozone problem. It varies from year to year, of course. There's natural variability on top of everything else. But the community of experts on that is confident that we're taking the right steps, and that the ozone layer is on track to heal, but it will take decades.
Decades. Can we scientifically say it has already begun to heal?
Well, I think we can say that we have taken the steps that are going to lead it to heal. But because you're still seeing serious ozone holes in the Antarctic spring last year and in other recent years, it's a long way from being finished.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware, Professor, of any experiments being done on our atmosphere? I know there are. There's, for example, HARP in Alaska that's doing some ionospheric research. Whether or not it has anything to do with the atmosphere, I'm not sure. But are you aware of anything of that nature?
Well, there are small scale experiments of all kinds. You know, the classical kind of experiment were the ones used to seed clouds or disperse fog at airports
right.
during the war and so on. But there have been things suggested, but there are no large scale experiments going on. As I said, there are ethical and legal ramifications to that.
Professor, I'm sorry again to interrupt, but we are at the top of the hour, so we've got to take a break here. Professor Richard Somerville is my guest. He's eminently well qualified to comment on the warming that's happening to our world right now. That's right. I'm going to open the lines. My guest is Professor Richard Somerville. Now, just taking a little sampling of what I'm getting on the computer, Tony in Tucson, Arizona, writes, enough liberal Nazi socialist political propaganda. Aren't I suggest you watch Glenn Beck's Exposed, A Climate of Fear on CNN and get the truth behind the media-driven hype of global warming. Then cease having alleged experts that spread these lies. Now, I wonder if these people have the cojones to come here on the air and actually, if not face-to-face, voice-to-voice, dispense this kind of angry rhetoric. There's so much of it here. Okay, phone lines are open. Let's hear from you. We'll be right back. Saying all this is polarized, Professor, is understating it. Richard in Loveland, Ohio. I mean, these are samples I can read. A lot of these I couldn't even read on the air. Says, follow the money, Art. Climate research is like any other kind. The more the belief in an alleged problem, the longer the flow of research grants will last. Anyone who claims there's no agenda here is either a liar or a fool. Professor?
Well, I've always wondered about this follow the money accusation. You know, my salary gets paid by the University of California. It's not dependent on global warming. You know, it's I've been there a long time, and it's you know, there's nothing I can say about global warming that increases or decreases my income. The research funding for this topic in this country is essentially flat. People, scientists who want to do research, write proposals to the government. They compete, and some small fraction of them are typically funded. And we use those research dollars to, you know, our computer charges and to help pay our graduate students and so on. There's just not a lot of money in here. In fact, if I wanted to make money on global warming, I might switch sides if that were my motivation and take up one of the skeptic think tank offers to write hostile reviews of the IPCC report at $10,000 a pop.
Well, now, Professor, where does that money come from, that skeptic money?
You know, I do not know. I do not know. But it's out there. And I think I just don't understand this follow the money thing. I don't think anybody goes into scientific research in a subject like this for the money. I try to persuade graduate students to come and get a PhD and take the pledge of poverty that calling like that requires. And sometimes they think, gee, I'd like to go into Wall Street. They're bright enough to do anything. So this is not not a money-driven issue here. I'm waiting to be told where the money is, because I'm just like
anybody else. Well, you just told us. You said, really, on the other side, there appears to be, even if you don't know where it's coming from or you don't want to say, there's plenty of money on the other side.
Well, I think, as I said, there has been a well-funded disinformation campaign that I hope is turning the corner. There are fewer corporations funding these skeptical propagandists, I would say, than there have been in the past. But frankly, I don't think this is money driven, and I don't doubt the sincerity of people who dispute the scientific consensus. In fact, I'm all for their doing research and publishing openly and so on. So I think they are mistaken scientifically, but science is self-correcting. You know, that's one of the great things about science. You wait long enough, and predictions that don't square with Mother Nature mean that that part of the science was wrong, and that's how we make progress. Science makes forecasts. We test it against the real world. And in the long run, claims that don't hold up fail and are dropped or modified. It's one of the very nice things about science. In the end, error is found out, and that's how we advance.
All right, let's give it a try. Joseph in Houston, Texas, you're on the air with Professor Somerville. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about something called the Little Ice Age. I saw a documentary on Discovery Channel about a ice age that occurred in like the 1500s and ended in the 1800s. And I'd like to. My question is that, do you think it has anything to do with like the global warming that's going on now?
Well, I'm glad to speak to that. The Little Ice Age is a fantastic example of a natural climate fluctuation. The problem with trying to analyze these relatively small fluctuations in the past is we don't have the data we need to fully understand them. So, for example, we don't know how widespread by 1600s. It wasn't a global network of thermometers. There was nobody with satellites and so on. And so we have, you might say, partial and incomplete information. There was a medieval warm period also prior to the Little Ice Age. And once again, we know that parts of the world were warm. There's no reason to think that the entire world was warm then. The IPCC, which looked at this very carefully and which included leading experts on these past climate changes, concluded that the recent warming is probably unprecedented in at least the last 1,300 years. So I think what we have to keep in mind is that there are natural fluctuations in climate, both recent and long ago. The Dust Bowl in this country in the 1930s is an example. That's as far as we know, was just Mother Nature flipping a coin. That was a random occurrence. It wasn't caused by human beings. And on top of that, there are the man-made causes. When we test this out in our computer models to replicate the observed warming in the last part of the 20th century, the first few years of this century, we can't do it just by putting in the natural factors, changes in the sun, for example, which may have had to do with the Little Ice Age, and changes in volcanoes. We can't reproduce it unless we also include the increase in the greenhouse effect. I think my metaphor for that would be forest fires. You know, there's forest fires started by natural causes. Lightning starts some forest fires. That doesn't mean that there aren't people that start forest fires too, either by accident or by arson. And so we're disentangling this mix of natural and man-made causes here. And scientific so far on that the recent warming is global extent.
We're beginning to have trouble with your cell connection, Professor.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's quite all right. There's not a thing you can do about it. We switched to a cell phone to get rid of the echo. Phil in Fort Myers, Florida, you're on the air with Professor Somerville.
Hello, Art. Sure love your show. Professor, I got a question basically about, just a quick question about global warming, but first just a quick comment, if I may, about where the money is. I agree, follow the money, but it's basically to the anti-warming people. Art's cohort during the week largely has on mostly anti-warming people who are all right-leaning for the most part. And clearly you can see the economics involved there on it. Several times he's claimed he can't get anybody with your position on that's credible to debate these people. So at any rate, going to that, on a greenhouse effect, is it pretty clearly understood by both sides that that's largely caused by the gases and that there in fact is a greenhouse effect, or do they debate that also?
That's a very good question, perfectly reasonable question, and I think the answer to that is that there's considerable unanimity on both sides about the reality of the natural greenhouse effect. Long before people started changing the atmosphere, there was a natural greenhouse effect. It's still there. There are gases in the atmosphere. Water vapor is the single most important one. Carbon dioxide is next. Methane and nitrous oxide, quite a few other gases in the atmosphere, have this property of being able to trap heat much like a blanket. In technical terms, they trap the infrared energy that the Earth would otherwise radiate to space. And without this natural greenhouse effect, which is as real as gravity, we would have a much less habitable planet, which on the average, the surface of the Earth would be below the freezing point of water. So the concern isn't with the natural greenhouse effect. The concern is that we're modifying it by adding to these naturally occurring gases, man-made gases too. So as I said, more than one out of four molecules of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today, and this is a known fact, nobody disputes it, is made by human activities, chiefly burning fossil fuels, but also other human activities like deforestation. And I think where the disagreement might come, and it's not a great disagreement in the science community, is what happens after that. What are the feedbacks? The climate system is full of all kinds of feedback. So, for example, the Arctic warms rapidly because as snow and ice melt, the darker surface that was under them absorbs more sunlight. It's less reflective. And that's the main reason why we see the strongest warming in the Arctic. It's as though you had your house wired funny, and when it heated up, it turned on the furnace instead of the air conditioner, made it still warmer. And that kind of feedback, and there are many of them in the climate system, are not all perfectly well understood. There are things still to learn. And the skeptics believe, I think, in general, I think it's fair to say that there'll be compensating feedbacks that do act like a thermostat that will resist the warming. Either the clouds will change, or the distribution of water vapor will change, or something else like that will change. And to date, the mainstream scientific community has looked carefully into each of these suggestions for a stabilizing feedback that would make the climate robust against human influence, and has failed to find one that's ubiquitous enough or strong enough to block the warming. So I think that's probably a fair statement of the mainstream scientific viewpoint at this point.
Professor, if nothing changes, at what point will all, virtually all, of the Arctic ice be gone?
Well, I think if nothing changes, it's largely gone by the end of this present 21st century. That has profound effects. It may allow navigation around northern Canada, for example, the Northwest Passage. It may destroy the indigenous way of life of Inuit people. It may have strong effects ecologically on species that depend on that ice. But we're not talking about something that's many years in advance. Some of our children and many of our grandchildren will see that.
Joe in Los Angeles, you're on the air.
Art, this is Joe. It's always a pleasure to speak to you from the Kingdom of L.A. I have a couple comments real quick for the professor, and then I'll save my question to the end. This issue always gets me so worked up. I'm in agreement with the professor that there is the warming and whatnot, and obviously humans are having some sort of effect on that. To that degree of effect, I guess, is where I would argue with the professor. Mainly my problem would stem with weathermen. If weathermen can't tell me exactly what's going to happen today, sometimes I'm originally from a town in the northeast corner of Missouri, and sometimes a weatherman would tell you it's doing one thing when you're looking out the window and you're seeing almost the opposite thing happening. How in the hell are they going to tell me what the hell's going to happen in 50 to 100 years, much less 1,000 years? The degree of severity as far as the global warming and the climate change, the Pope of this whole issue, Al Gore, if there was such severity in his words, if this devastation was around the corner, why is the man around in private jets? Why is he using up all these kilowatts in his house in Tennessee? I mean, you would think that somebody who truly believes in his life's work would be taking the bus, walking, doing whatever he's got to do. I realize he's a very important man, and he's got to get around the globe. His private plane probably put more carbon footprint up in the sky than any of all of us combined just on his press tour for the movie. In speaking with people, when you talk on this subject, they get so mad. Well, didn't you see the movie? Didn't you see the movie? Of course we saw the movie, but it's propaganda like every other movie. I watch movies all the time, and you watch them for entertainment purposes. When you watch a documentary, you have to understand someone has an agenda. Look at the director, Davis Guggenheim. You talk about following the money. There's disinformation on both sides.
Okay, caller, do you have a question? What would you calculate your question to be?
The question would be, how are you going to believe a weatherman that can't tell you what's happening today or tomorrow?
All right. It's a good one. All right. So we can't get the weather right from even sometimes I look at the weather forecast for my area, Professor, and sure enough, as he points out, they don't even have it right for what's going on right now. So how can you forecast way into the future?
That's a perfectly good question, and I'm happy to answer it. I'll start off by saying that weather forecasts have improved. You know, they're better than they used to be. It's always fun to kick the poor weatherman, but the people whose livelihood depends on weather forecasts, people, pilots and farmers and so on, will tell you that they have gotten more skillful. The forecast of Hurricane Katrina's track and land was extraordinarily good. But the scientific answer to that is that weather is different from climate. You know, climate deals with averages and statistics, and weather deals with specific events. And predicting the weather more than a few days in advance runs you into the problem of the butterfly effect. You know, the butterfly flaps its wings in one part of the world, changes things in another part of the world. It's chaos. It's nonlinear dynamics. It's what the mathematicians call sensitive dependence on initial conditions. We can't observe the world perfectly. It's an unstable situation. The weather's like the twig in a stream or the pinball going down the pinball machine, hits one peg, bounces off, goes another way. You can't predict where it will end up. But I think a better way to think of it, a more clear way, is to say that we can't predict the future of any individual. You know, we can't predict when a specific person, for example, will die. But the statistics of life expectancy for large populations, very predictable. That's how life insurance companies fix their rates and still make money. And so you're dealing with the statistics of something over a long period rather than with specific events. So you can't say, for example, it's going to rain at 3 p.m. on the 4th of July next year in London. But you might be able to say that London next summer is going to be drier or wetter or warmer or cooler than normal.
With a higher degree of accuracy.
With a higher degree of accuracy. Also, weather is a spheric phenomenon. You know, the weather is the state of the atmosphere. But the climate involves parts of the climate system that have much longer timescales, like the ocean circulation. It may take the deep ocean 1,000 years to turn over, for a parcel of water to sink, travel underneath, and come to the surface again. The world of ice and snow has very long timescales. That also means that these effects occur far in the future, which is politically difficult. But climate is inherently more predictable than weather. We know, for example, ice ages come and go because of changes in the Earth's orbit, and these are regular. They're not chaotic. They don't depend on the butterfly, and so we can hindcast them, and that's how we know that ice ages occur in synchrony with these changes in the orbit of the Earth. We've learned a lot about the climate system. It may not be perfectly predictable, but we know that if we continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and trap heat, that it's going to warm. You know, the first real estimate of that was made by a great scientist named Arrhenius. He was Swedish. He made them around 1900. He was no slouch. He won a Nobel Prize in chemistry for other work. And his prediction of how much a given increase in carbon dioxide would warm the world is within about a factor of two of modern predictions. So this is science that's been refined for quite a while.
Okay, very quickly, Clark in Calgary in Canada, you're on the air with Professor Somerville. Hi.
Good afternoon, or good evening, Professor, and good evening, Art.
Hi.
We were looking with a group of professors and academia from here in Alberta, and some of them are sitting, they don't like all the propaganda, and they're not quite agreeing with some of the models, but they don't like the other side that they're on. So they're kind of like academia stuck in the middle. One of the things we did look at was removing argon from the atmosphere because it is it's a noble gas, you know, inert, and going and sequestering it. And if we need to warm back up, go and release it again.
All right, Clark, I'm going to ask you, Clark, to hold on through the break. Can you do that? Clark? Hello, Clark? Well, I'm going to hope Clark can hold on through the break, because that's what we're getting right now. Professor Richard Somerville is my guest. I'm Art Bell.